When I was 17 years old, standing out in the driveway one Saturday afternoon, sweeping the leaves off the driveway or something, my mother came up to me and she said, "By the way, you know that you are not my first child." No, you know, I was there for 4 years, and then my brother was there after that, but I wasn't aware of anybody before me. So I was kind of stunned. But I get ahead of myself. Let me see if I can get my laptop turned on here. Come on. Before I really get any further, though, I want to ask everybody to take a moment and remember Sarah Lynn Griffith, who died about 4 days ago, I think, and hold her and hold Kelly in your hearts. And remember also that tomorrow is 9/11, and whatever that means to you, it means something, no doubt about it. So let's just take a moment, and then I'll start back up again. Moment is supposed to be about 90 seconds, but I'm going to make this a short moment. I grew up in Atlanta, Georgia, one of two children, as I now understand. Went to St. Luke's Episcopal Church. Here's a picture of me when I was probably 8 years old as a choir boy. Yeah, I know. You can't really see it from there, but come down and look at it if you want to. When I was about in seventh grade, because we didn't get a TV set until I was in seventh grade. And my parents and my brother and I were sitting in the den watching the first, as far as I know, Billy Graham crusade. And he was quite impressive. He was quite a speaker. He was quite moving. And at some point in his speaking, he urged everyone who wanted to accept Jesus to come down to the front of whatever the space was. And people at home watching on TV, get on your knees and accept Jesus. Well, man, I flung myself right down on my knees, closed my eyes, and knelt on the floor there in the den in front of the TV. And nothing happened. So after a moment or a few, I looked over, and there were my mother and my father and my brother sitting in their chairs, trying not to look at me kneeling on the floor. So that passed, you know, and I continued going to St. Luke's. I was a choir boy. I became an altar boy at some point. And in my eighth grade Sunday school class, I'll never forget this. We were sitting around, and our teacher was a young man, probably 25. And he stands up in front of the group. We were sort of in a circle. And he's holding a book in his hand. And if you look, you can see it's the Bible. And he held it out for all of us to look at. And then he took it and he flung it on the floor and he said, "It's just a book." That was more stunning than my non-conversion experience with Billy Graham. I went on ninth grade, 12th grade, attended an all-Catholic, a Catholic all-male military high school in Atlanta called Marist, dressed up in uniforms every day. Taught by Catholic priests, Catholic fathers. Morning, Kitty. It was the only private school my parents could afford, and they wanted me to go to private school because at that point integration was happening in the public schools, and there was a lot of agitation to close the public schools rather than integrate them. So I went to this Catholic military school. Continued attending the local Episcopal Church. We moved out to Roswell, Georgia by that time. Dated the minister's daughter, went to Episcopal Young Church in the evening, but noticed that I was less and less involved with the message of the church. It just wasn't, I just wasn't getting it. wasn't speaking to me. But I did go to college at an Episcopal college, University of the South, Suwannee, on the edge of the Cumberland Plateau in Tennessee. Absolutely gorgeous, beautiful place. We had required chapel. The chapel was just one of the most beautiful buildings I had ever seen, and it had more seats in it than our football stadium did. I attended chapel, but I stopped taking communion because, as I said to a friend of mine my junior year, standing in another parking lot — there's something about parking lots in my life, driveways and parking lots — I stopped taking communion because I told a friend of mine in my junior year, "I don't believe in God." His response was, "You will when you get to be 70. I turned 71 back last July. We'll talk about that more in a minute. After finishing college and going to graduate school and getting my PhD finally wrapped up and done, I got my first real job working at the Mental Health Center in High Point, North Carolina. Had some wonderful experiences there. And one of them was, I just loved some of my clients. And one of them was this woman who was in a very, very unhappy marriage. This was when I worked with Fred and Vicki. And this woman was in a very unhappy marriage. She wanted desperately to get out of it. She had two or maybe three children. And as she talked with me about it, it was clear to her that she could not leave her marriage. She couldn't handle what it would take to take care of the children and make the money and just everything. So I said to her, well, let's call her Susan. "Susan, if you were lost in a forest and had tried unsuccessfully to find your way out and you couldn't, what would you do?" And her response was something along the lines of, "I'd find a clearing in the forest, I'd build myself a shelter, and then I'd plant a garden." So, in essence, that's what she did. I stopped seeing her after a while. 20 years later, more or less, I ran into one of her kids, her daughters, who I also had seen for a while in therapy. And we chatted a little bit, and she said, "My mother is still married to my father, and she is as happy as she has ever been." So her garden, her forest clearing worked for her. In my middle years, I dated a woman when I first moved to Greensboro. I re-met a woman that I'd known a little bit in Chapel Hill, and we dated for a long, long time. She was a born-again Christian, very, very fine, wonderful person. She eventually ran afoul of the administration in the nursing school at UNCG, and she was refused tenure, and she had to leave, and she washed up into Jackson, Mississippi, working for the VA. I went down to see her and had a very nice visit with her, and she took me to a lot of different places, including a place called the Pearl River, which flows near Jackson, Mississippi. And we were looking at it, and it was a very high, sandy bluff looking down over the river. And she said, "Vance, I want to ask you to do something." I said, "What's that, Gail?" She said, "I want you to get down on your knees and open your heart and invite Jesus to come in." So I said, "Okay." And I got down on my knees there in this beautiful, beautiful place, closed my eyes, did the best I could to open my heart. Nothing happened. He didn't come again. Where are you? Gail and I broke up. we still cared for each other deeply, but she was in Mississippi, etc. So I eventually got married to — you're not supposed to get smaller, you're supposed to move. I got married to a woman. And when I told a friend of mine from graduate school that I was going to get married, she said, "Would you like me to cast the I Ching for your marriage?" And I said, "Sure." So So the next time I saw her, I said, well, what did the I Ching say? And she said, I'm not sure I should tell you. Oh, go ahead. She said, the best I can understand it, it says, one will drown so that the other may live. Now, that's quite an entrance into a marriage. But we got married. We stayed married for about 5 years. I got involved with the Sierra Club, my Sierra Club hat. I did a lot of work with the Red Cross at that time, increasingly an important part of my life. My marriage ended after she had gotten to the other shore and hadn't drowned, I thought, and that's probably true. Then I fell in love with a woman named Jenny, loved her 3 children, loved the Christmas tree farm that she bought and then I worked on, a place called Caleb's Ridge up in Ashe County. I was as happy as I had ever been. There was, however, a foreshadowing of disaster lying ahead. We had, as we did every year for 5 years, we had a fall equinox gathering. People came up and camped, and we had a fire ring, and just hung out, and it was just lovely. And at some point during the last one, I was standing with a friend looking out over the fire ring and everything, and I said to my friend, my friends, I think I'll keep them. My girlfriend, I hope she'll keep me. Well, a little bit over 3 months, she didn't. I got asked to go to Guam over Christmas and New Year's of 2002 into 2003. I thought, you know, these people have been hit by a typhoon and then a super typhoon. How can I have any pretense of being a caring person and not go and help? But I tried to find the out. I asked my friend and her son if it was okay with them if I left over Christmas to go to Guam, and they both encouraged me to go, said we. They thought I should go. So I did. I came back, and 2 days after getting back, I got ditched. Oh, well. Well, the well was I fell into a deep, many, many months deep depression, probably psychotic at times. I was a mess, a real, real mess. I started after a while to search for community again and a sense of purpose. I got re-involved with the Sierra Club, which I had not been spending any time with. And I got involved with the Truth and Reconciliation local task force. This was when the Truth and Reconciliation Commission was being put into place and coming up on 25 years after the 1979 Klan Nazi massacre, which was, by the way, 3 months after I moved to Greensboro. I was unwilling or unable or whatever to establish another love relationship. I just didn't have it in me. Well, one of the people I met on the Truth and Reconciliation Task Force was a woman named Eileen Curry. Some of you know Eileen Curry. And Eileen Curry had said to me at some point, you should come to the church I'm going to. Why not? I came one Sunday morning, and there was a musician playing. I don't remember who it was. And then Jim Dollar spoke. And I sat in this absolutely lovely, lovely sanctuary, and I was just swept up by the gathering of sojourners. I joined so that I might have a vote. But this was a gathering of sojourners, and sojourners, by definition, are not people that are going to stay somewhere. They're people who are going somewhere, and they come together and they gather together. I was looking through the directory from 2009, 8 years ago, October the 1st. And lo and behold, there's Kelly Griffith and Sarah Lynn Griffith right there looking at us. So the gathering of sojourners was immensely important to me. And then many, many, many of the sojourners moved on, and we have what we have now. And I'm still here. As I think of it, in my clearing in the forest with my garden. But I still don't believe. I'm an atheist. what's an atheist doing in a progressive Christian church? Well, I'm doing, as a friend of mine, a supervisor of mine said in graduate school, everybody's doing the best they can. So here I am, I'm doing the best I can. I know I'm making a contribution, and I'm glad to be making a contribution. I'm proud to be a part of this group, and I'm proud to have y'all as my friends and my family and everything else. My thoughts are evolving about where I'm going and where we might go. So in honor of what happened 15 years ago at that fall equinox party, and in honor of 9/11, and mostly in honor of us and in honor of the change, the fall equinox, I've asked if I could rent the sanctuary on Friday, the day of the fall equinox, 4:02 p.m. So at 4 o'clock, unless there's some conflict that I'm not aware of at this point, I'm going to be here. I invite anyone else that would like to come to come. I had hoped to get Emma Lee, who sang here last week, to sing for us, but she's going to be with her sisters and some sisters gathering somewhere else. So I don't know about music yet, but that's where we are, and now, Gracia, for our period of silence. Am I on again? I told Gracia I wanted to say one thing before she asked if anybody had any comments or questions. This is as good a time as any to finish the story about my older sibling. 35 years after my mother told me that, I asked her older sister, my Aunt Aline. My mother had been dead for years by that time. I asked Aunt Aline to tell me what she knew about that. And her response was, I know that that didn't happen, Vance. Well, then why did she tell me that, Aline? She said, your mother and I were very close. If she'd been pregnant, I would have known. If she'd been pregnant and lost a child, I certainly would have known. That never happened. Well, why did she tell me that, Aline? Your mother liked attention. And she made up stories to get attention. So I carried that story with me and made it part of my life, and it was part of my life for 35 years. And then I had to figure out what to do to try to undo that story. You can't just erase that off the blackboard. So anyway, that's what that was. That's why I became a psychologist, I guess.
Thanks. Thank you so much for that story. I think we need more Povich to find your sibling. So now we have 10 minutes for an opportunity for a response. This is the dialogue time.
I've known Vance since dirt.
Long time.
I never heard that story. Moving. Thank you. Mm-hmm. You're very eloquent. I appreciate that. And you're my best friend. Thank you.
Say again.
not my best friend, but a very good friend. And I thank you.
Thanks, Fred. I'm right back at you.
I'm Susan. Thank you, Vance, for sharing your story. It occurs to me that each of us has a story of how we got to where we are now. And I hope that yours is just the first one of people that are willing to share their stories. Mine is long and complicated. But I got here too, and I'm glad.
I'm glad too. I'm glad too, Susan.
Good morning. I'm Elsie. Thank you, Vance. I think your story in part speaks to the thing that labels are often unhelpful, if not destructive. What I know of you is that you've spent your life caring about other people and caring about our planet. And you mentioned Eileen, who is now something of a difficult person, and you go to see her and you visit her, and you may be among few people who do that, who still care about her. And I noticed that about you, and I appreciate it, and I thank you.
Thank you, Elsie. Full disclosure, I have not been to see Eileen in a while because she is a very difficult person. So if there's anybody else that would like to spend any time with Eileen and just be with her, I'll go with you. It's just hard for me to go by myself and be with her.
Yes, I visited with Eileen. I work well with difficult people. Who had their hand up?
I think one of the things about what you had to say today is we were talking about labels. It's more important how you live your life than how you label yourself. And I can't think of anything that Christ taught about how to live your life that you probably, it's going to come back negative, but there's nothing you do that's not in the way Christ taught us to live.
Oh, no, you just don't know.
We don't want to tell everything.
Vance, I appreciate you sharing your story and being willing to put yourself out there with this congregation. And you made me think about what's the nature of belief. Why is belief so important to us and so forth? And I'd like to challenge our minister, Mark Salen, to take that as one of his themes one day, because he really does an excellent job of helping me understand things.
I'll accept that challenge, and I'll share with you the one thing that my kids now are 21 and 18, but growing up, what I always taught them and what I told them was, I don't care what you believe, as long as you don't hurt people. And you get bonus points if you help them.
Any other comment?
Gracia, let me respond real quickly to Ralph's comment before. Can you hold on just a second, Tom? Thank you. I said I don't believe in God. To the best of my understanding, that's true. But I do have a goddess that I believe in. And that's the goddess Synchronicity. When I was 16 years old, I pulled out of the stacks in the library in downtown Atlanta a book by Carl Jung titled On Synchronicity, an A-Causal Principle. And to me, synchronicity means coincidence, things happening together in ways that have some meaning to them. So for me, for example, to bring this directory and sort of wave it around to say, look how many people are no longer here and look how many people are here now. And then to see Kelly Griffith and Sarah Lynn Griffith smiling up at me, that to me is synchronicity. That means something.
Well, thanks, Vance, for sharing that. I really like that the analogy of the meadow and the wilderness was particularly good. But also, I should have thanked you years ago, because years ago you spoke and mentioned the your professor saying everybody's doing their best. Mm-hmm. And in the years since, you know, when I'm exasperated by someone and I say, how is it possible that guy could be doing his best and that, I found that to be a very helpful way to look at it.
And, me too, Tom. Me too.
As you spoke today with that analogy, you know, I'm thinking about myself and others that I know and thinking, well, figuratively speaking, that's what they're doing. And I find that helpful. I'm grateful for that. Thanks.
Not the best that they can ever do, but the best they can do right now. With
yes, and in my time, when you, to get you to do better, they use a switch.
Gracia.
Well, that's when my alarm clock went off this morning. I was really wishing somebody else was speaking today.
Me too, when mine went off.
because I would probably just now be getting up if that had been the case. And reflecting on what you had to say from Annie, I probably know you better than Annie does. So.
Differently.
But thanks for what you had to say. And I noticed your topic is what are we doing here? And I think you told why you're here or what you're trying to do here. And I think all of us probably have a different story on that. Mm-hmm. And I think it's probably more intentional in this place than any church I've ever been in. So thanks for bringing it up.
Thanks, brother.